Hi, I'm Andrew Proctor, and you're listening to a special episode of the Archive Project, in which we're featuring events from 2017's Portland Book Festival, presented by Bank of America. The 2018 lineup has just been announced, and the festival will take place on November 10th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, a conversation from our book festival in 2017. The event was entitled Disruption, Feminist Digital Culture, and featured the writers Dori Shaffir and Ellen Ullman, and was moderated by Jasmine Hughes from the New York Times. What these two writers have in common is their deep involvement in digital culture, be it as a programmer in the case of Ellen Ullman, or at an online startup in the case of Dori Shaffir. They complement each other because Ullman's experience begins in the late 1970s and Shaffir in the early 2000s. These two voices give us four decades of perspective of women in tech. A conversation with this depth and nuance seems essential to getting below the soundbites to a more fulsome understanding of the challenges women face in this industry that is both changing fast and not fast enough. This conversation took place in November of 2017, and so the hashtag MeToo movement was just beginning to go viral. Here's Hughes.
Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Jasmine Hughes. I'm an associate editor at the New York Times Sunday Magazine. And I'm here with you today to talk to Dori Shaffir and Ellen Ullman. Dori Shaffir is a senior tech writer at BuzzFeed News, and Startup is her first novel. Dori has also been on staff at Rolling Stone, The New York Observer, Gawker, Philadelphia Weekly, and has contributed to The New York Times, The New Yorker, Slate, The All, New York Magazine, Marie Claire, and Wired. She grew up outside Boston, lived in New York for 9 years, and now resides in Los Angeles with her husband, Matt Mira, a comedy writer and podcaster. Ellen Ullman wrote her first computer program in 1978. She went on to have a 20-year career as a programmer and software engineer. Her writings have become landmark works describing the social, emotional, and personal effects of technology. Her essays, opinion pieces, book reviews, and short fiction have appeared in the New York Times, The Washington Post, Harper's, Wired, Salon, Tablet, and The American Scholar, as well as in several best-selling collections. She's the author of two novels, By Blood, a New York Times notable book, and The Bug, a runner-up for the Penn Hemingway Award. Her memoir, Close to the Machine, about her life as a software engineer during the internet's first rise, became a cult classic. And her new book, Life in Code, A Personal History of Technology, tells the evolving story of the technical world as she experienced it, sorry, it's my handwriting, while living in its midst for more than two decades. She is based in San Francisco. You guys, join me in a round of applause for Dori and Ellen, please.
Thanks, Jasmine.
Now that we've gotten the hardest part of the way, which is reading my handwriting, we're going to start with the questions. So the two of you both written books about tech. That's why we're all here. But both of the books take place in wildly different time periods. And I wonder if you guys could both talk about your experiences as to the quote-unquote vibe of the tech scene or various tech offices as you saw them. Dori, do you want to start?
Sure. So I work at BuzzFeed. I've been there for 5.5 years. And when I started there, it was very much it really felt like a startup. It had some similarities to the startups in my book, but it's not exactly the same. But, you know, there's some details here and there that are similar. It was in a former factory building in Flatiron, and there were probably like 60 people there at the time, and we had inspirational sayings on the walls, and everyone kind of felt like, yeah, we're changing the world through lists. and that was, I'd written a cover story for New York Magazine in 2010 about the New York, kind of like the burgeoning New York tech scene. And something that I found when I wrote that piece was that these tech companies, in a way, felt very like un-New York to me. They were all so earnest and, yes. and, you know, and just really believed in that they were changing the world in a way that New York felt more cynical to me. Older New York felt more cynical to me. So I was really interested in the way that tech companies were kind of engaging with the ecosystem of New York City.
And how did you feel working in these relatively uncynical places? Was it crazy for you, or did you sort of get with that program?
You get with the program, but it is a little weird, especially, you know, I started at BuzzFeed and I was in my 30s and a lot of my coworkers were in their 20s and this was kind of all they'd ever known. Mm-hmm. And I had worked at Gawker, which was not an earnest place.
Slightly
less nice. Yeah. And then at the New York Observer, which also sort of took this gimlet-eyed approach to the world. And so to be at this place where you were encouraged to be an enthusiast, that was a word that got tossed around a lot, was a little disorienting at first. But then it's also like, oh, this is kind of a nice way to live, you know, be positive about things.
And Ellen, you actually speak at length, or write at length, about how you felt in these companies. But could you take us back to the beginning of your career and talk about what the tone of your offices were like?
Well, I think this is a great pairing, because we were talking when we first met in the green room. And my work starts when I was a programmer. The book starts in 1994. These are all pieces that are written in that time. So they're snapshots of technology as it boom, 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 went through the very first boom, and then the bust. And then I have a section on artificial intelligence and how that was developing, finally coming up to 2017. So I think my book kind of gives the roots of where we are now. The startup I worked in was Sybase, a database company that got destroyed and eaten by Oracle. But there were just enough women there that made it tolerable. I worked, I'm going to read a little bit about this. We were three in this team, and one of them would not speak in meetings. I had to communicate with him through email, and it was text-based in those days. And we had a whiteboard. And so he, you know, emailed me, "See the whiteboard, I put something up on it." I look at the whiteboard, I go, "What? Is that a new box or arrow? What's there?" And I'd have to, write back, "Well, I don't see it. You know, tell me what it is." And he would say, "Well, it's that yellow thing, in the corner." Can you imagine? We were building a human user interface. This was on Unix. There were no standard interfaces then. So here we are building an interface to actual human beings, and this man won't talk to me. So, went on. I went on through there, through Sun Microsystems, their research wing, and these were guys who treated me like I was an idiot. One mistake made by a woman, and you're dead. So they were brutal with each other, heavy code reviews. I guess what I'm talking about is from the inside out. We're coders. We're the people instantiating these systems. We're in these companies that have designed what we're supposed to do. And so our whole values are moving into the code and coming out through the programs we create into the culture. We were, in a sense, programming the society that would evolve around computers. So the software engineering part is, to me, fascinating. When I wrote my first program and I got it to run, I went, "Oh, it works." I taught myself to code. And so that is a great experience. I want to have that again. I was seduced. So the vibe is very different. I mean, you see in the software engineering world, so it's technically really challenging, and the men I worked around were tough on me. You know, a woman stands out, and so you can't just be good, you have to be better. Sometimes you come in and you get that technical test. You know, they put you with somebody looking over a guy's shoulder. Well, do you see anything that's wrong with this? You imagine, you walk in. This is like stuff at Google. This is kind of the interviews they do at Google. You know, build a program to turn Bitcoin into paper checks that we'll put in the mail. It's ridiculous, but. So when I go on in time, I arrive at where you are now in your book, which really nails the current culture. And what I see and what you see. Now, my startup was, we had to have two profitable quarters before we could go into the public market. Imagine that. But now, companies go public when they're losing $845 million in a quarter, as Uber did, yet they're valued at $10 billion. So this is what the first boom was. The first boom was profits don't matter. What matters are eyeballs, and you monetize the eyeballs, and as long as you're growing and you're getting more eyeballs, you know, yeah. And so that's why all these companies, their valuations went up, 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 and finally, there was nothing in there. There was some that survived. And I'm afraid we're doing something like that right now. They were kind of companies, these small startups, they're given money, it's just money, 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 and they're not profitable. The era that's very different now, and I write about also, is this change the world. This idea of do what you love. If you don't like your job, make your own job. Now, how many people in the world could possibly do this? Yeah. The vast race of human beings on Earth cannot possibly say, well, if you don't like your job, create one, you do. So this air of, you know, this, you're doing noble things, this is new to me. And it's horrifying. All these people think, when they're changing the world, I ask them, from what to what? And there's a blank. I just like, for the better. Okay. And to me, this is a frightening development. I think your book really, really nails that. So
thank you.
We're really on the same, literally the same page.
Something you both sort of circled around just now is the idea of a company culture that often excludes women. Doreen, your book, the idea, and also in your book, Ellen, the idea of a good fit or a best fit mm-hmm. for someone came up several times. And that combined with the often sophomoric behavior of many of the men at the company, like the unicorn dress-up day mm-hmm. that happens in your mm-hmm. book, what sort of roles do you think women are relegated to in instances like this?
Well, I do think cultural fit is often used to mask a lot of just discriminatory practices. You know, if the people doing the hiring, let's say, are all white men in their 20s who like to go out and drink after work every day, then what is that culture? That's the culture. And so that automatically excludes a lot of other people. But you know, since you're not allowed to discriminate in hiring, theoretically, you kind of get around it by saying, well, they weren't a culture fit. And, you know, there's all sorts of other things that fall under that euphemism. You know, it's really hard for parents, for example.
Right. Right.
How do you fit into the culture if you can't go out and drink every night with your coworkers, or even not drinking, if you know, you can't stay till 10 o'clock at night, for example. You know, then you're not a cultural fit. So I think that that has been a big problem in Silicon Valley, that, and in New York, in any tech environment, that I think people are becoming a little bit more cognizant of, but it's really hard to change these like big hegemonic systems. And that was something that I was definitely interested in exploring in my book. You know, the people at the top are, yes, there are women at the company, but the people at the top are all white men. The people making the decisions are white men.
Young white men
who have been given a lot of money, and there's really no accountability, there's no oversight, and sometimes that works out fine, and a lot of times it doesn't. So,
my book has the exact same thing about cultural fit. This is an incident that actually happened. I would go around and go to these sessions where would-be CEOs would give pitches. And they go from something like dialing for dollars to you get to do 8 slides, which is considered a professional presentation. It's and then there are the judges who decide, you know, who might get money and anyone in the audience who wants to approach them and, you know, give them seed money. It's a really horrifying process, and it's mostly men. And I spoke with one guy afterwards, you know, networking. Everyone networks. It's just another horrifying development to me. so he came up to me. I usually hug the wall. And he said, well, I'm building a new app, and do you want to hear about it? Well, yeah. And he says, well, it's for corporations to help them find a good fit. A good fit, you're just perpetuating the culture that you have there. You're excluding the same people, perpetuating segregated society. He listens to me patiently, and he says, I'm not working for society, I'm working for the company. So this tells you the mentality that goes on. And I have one more anecdote to add to this about the parents. I don't know who here has heard about the James Damore memo, the Google engineer who, I could talk for hours, and he doesn't deserve hours. But one of the things he said was that women can't be good software engineers because they won't stay all night and sleep under their desks. So you have to understand that culture exactly, that it's pre-adult men. Right? So, you know, they don't have anything to do, and they can bring their dogs to work. So they don't need dog workers. So really, you know, the idea is, you know, a woman has to go home and do something. She has a life. And this guy, James Damore, he thinks this is what makes a good software engineer, is to curl up under your desk with your dog. I mean, what's funny about that is that it's pre-adult, but also it's bad engineering. Anyone who does something hard and complicated knows. You have to step back and get away, and things occur to you. So it's both discriminatory and stupid.
There are so many frustrating men in both of your books that I often wanted to launch my book across the room. But before we get to that, and we will get to that, I'm wondering if you guys each have a selection from your book that you want to read, just to give everybody a little idea of what we're talking about. Ellen, do you want to start?
Sure. This is from the first chapter in the book. It's called The Programming Life, Reflections on the Programming Life, Outside of Time. This is the same story about my working in this company and the guy who wouldn't talk to me. So I'm selecting it because I think it gives you some of the origins of that submit button that you must press. It's written in parts. Part 7. I once designed a graphical user interface with a man who wouldn't speak to me. My boss hired the man without letting anyone else sit in on the interview. My boss lived to regret it. I was asked to brief my new colleague, and with a third member of the team, we went into a conference room. There we covered whiteboards with lines, boxes, circles, and arrows in 4 marker colors. After about half an hour, I noticed the new hire had become very agitated. Are we going too fast? I asked him. Too much for the first day, the third team member said. No, said our new man. I just can't do it like this. Do what? I asked. Like what? His hands were deep in his pockets. He gestured with his elbows. Like this, he said. You mean design? I said. You mean in a meeting? Asked the third. No answer from our new colleague. A shrug, another elbow gesture. Something terrible was beginning to occur to me. You mean talking? Yeah, talking. I can't do it by talking. So how can you do it? Mail, he said. Send me email. So corporations across North America and Europe were still using a system designed by three people who sent email that was text-based, one of whom barely spoke at all. I'll read just a little more to talk about interfaces. I think short at this time. Pretty graphical interfaces are commonly called user-friendly, but they are not really your friends. Underlying every user interface is a terrific human contempt. The basic idea of a graphical interface is that it does not allow anything alarming to happen. You can pound on the mouse button all you want. The system should prevent you from doing anything stupid. A monkey can pound on the keyboard. Your cat can run across it. Your baby can bang it with a fist. But the system should not crash. To build such a crash-resistant system, the designer must be able to imagine and disallow the dumbest action. He or she cannot simply rely on the user's intelligence. Who knows who will be on the other side of the program? Besides, the user's intelligence is not quantifiable. It's not programmable. It cannot protect the system. The real task is to forget the intelligent person on the other side and think of every stupid single thing anyone might possibly do. In the designer's mind, gradually, over months and years, there is created a vision of the user as imbecile. The imbecile vision is mandatory. No good crash-resistant system can be built except if it's done for an idiot. The prettier the user interface, the fewer odd replies the system allows you to make, the dumber you once appeared in the mind of the designer. The designer's contempt for your intelligence is mostly hidden deep in the code, but now and then the disdain surfaces. Here's a small example. You're trying to do something simple like back up your files on a Mac. The program proceeds for a while, then encounters an error. Your disk is defective, says the message. Below the message is a single button. You absolutely must click this button. If you don't click it, the program will hang there indefinitely. So, your disk is defective, your files may be all bollocksed up, the designer leaves you only one possible reply. You must say, okay.
Ellen, listening to you read that, I'm struck by the fact that we have a baby in here who is speaking more than that designer actually ever did to you.
That system will resist that baby.
Doreen, do you want to go ahead? I also have your book. Do you want to read from this?
Oh, I have it on okay. my phone here.
Of course you do.
I also just noted that when we were talking, as we were talking about cultural fit, a gentleman in the front row got up and left. anyway, okay, so I'm going to read a bit from a chapter told from the perspective of a character named Sabrina, and she is 36 years old, and she's working at this company where her boss is 10 years younger than she is. She's just re-entered the workforce after staying at home with her kids for a few years, and you'll see what happens. Sabrina was an engagement ninja. When she first applied, she thought this was a euphemism, not an actual job title. At Takeoff, whose offices were in a lofty Flatiron District building that a million years ago had been a garment factory and now housed at any one time approximately 17 startups. They were mostly tech-related, but there was a smattering of other companies like the bespoke baby clothing designer on the second floor. The entire building was run by ShareWork, a company that leased empty buildings around the city and then subdivided them into cool workspaces. Every office came with a customizable employee perks package. Standard was an iced coffee, kegerator, a ping pong table, weekly chair massages, and building-wide lunchtime yoga classes in one of the shared conference rooms. When Sabrina had worked for the Eco Crafting magazine, the break room was essentially a closet with a microwave, a dorm-sized fridge, and a coffee maker that you had to bring in your own coffee to use. At Takeoff, the employees had successfully rallied to get Stumptown back after the office manager had, out of nowhere, tried switching them over to Starbucks. After Stumptown returned, there had been an hour-long celebratory coffee break in the canteen, where a hired barista made espresso drinks for everyone. The office itself was a big room where everyone sat at long tables. There were huge windows on the south side that made everything very bright much of the time. On the walls were prints with cheeky inspirational sayings like, "I'm not here to be average, I'm here to be awesome," and "do epic shit." The only actual office was a glass-walled room in the corner with a comfy velvet sofa. It belonged to Takeoff's founder and CEO, Mac McAllister. Sabrina made her way to her workstation. She sat next to an intern on one side and her boss, Isabel, on the other. At the Eco-Crafting magazine, they'd been in cubicles, and Sabrina had initially found the level of closeness in the Takeoff office oppressive. She still hated the very word workstation, which always made her think of an assembly line. Forget about private phone calls. You could barely send private emails. But now she was used to it, and besides, hardly anyone ever made phone calls here. All of the people at the level above Sabrina were called heroes. There was an engineering hero, a product hero, a sales hero, and a biz dev hero. Isabel was 26, exactly 10 years younger than Sabrina, but she had been at Takeoff for 2.5 years, almost as long as the company had been around. She had started as Mac's assistant and been promoted rapidly. Neither Isabel nor the intern, who came in 3 days a week, was there yet. Sabrina got to work before almost anyone else so that she could leave at 5, which was practically mid-afternoon for most people in the office. But that had been a condition of her hiring that she had insisted on. She needed to be home before 6 so that she could let the nanny leave and eat dinner with her kids. Dan, her husband, who worked 3 floors down from her in the same building, had asked for no such concessions and usually didn't walk in the door before 7 or 8. Sabrina put down her still unfinished coffee in her bag, took off her jacket, and woke up her computer. She sat and closed her eyes and breathed deeply. She'd been skeptical when Mac brought in the meditation guru, a woman named Carly with impossibly long and shiny dark brown hair parted in the middle, who was bi-coastal and alluded to her celebrity clientele. But Sabrina had actually found some of Carly's techniques useful, like just closing your eyes and breathing. A little moment for your soul to heal, Carly liked to say in her soothing voice. Sometimes that was all it took. Thanks.
Aren't millennials the worst? I say, as a 26-year-old who's not yet started a company, and I really have to change my plans the rest of the day.
Oh, no, but you're in cool media, so, you know, you get to your exception.
Thank you for calling the New York Times cool. I'm going to take that back to everyone. But so the reason why I had that sort of snide comment, Dory, after you finished reading is because I was reading the book, and I was infuriated at points because it was so realistic, and there were so many things, such as the inspirational sayings that I know happen in startup culture that feel really condescending in ways. Mm-hmm. Like we're pre-adults, and there are many, many pre-adults, Ellen, as you just said, but the thing that really sort of like scared me the most is how realistic the app is in the book, the meditation app. That sort of buzzes in. It scans, correct me if I'm wrong, it scans your emails and your text messages for keywords, and then it buzzes in to give you like a little pep message.
Yeah.
As the day goes on.
Your social media, your email, everything on your phone, and it knows when you're feeling down, and it sends you a little.
Isn't that the craziest thing you've ever heard? And I was reading this on the subway in Brooklyn, and I would look up, and everybody would be reading on their phones, and I was like, I'm part of the problem. But I think, speaking as millennial, and I claim us all, but I think a lot of what frustrated me, especially as someone not in tech whatsoever, is the idea that technology can stand in for a friend or for a relationship. And that's the thing, and it frustrates me and it saddens me, and I'm just curious what your thoughts are on this, and if you think this is a positive thing and I should just get over myself or what? Maybe there's an app for that.
Well, I personally have conflicting feelings about the power of social media. I think that it can be, it has been used as a force for good. And I have, you know, I personally have made connections on social. Right. I feel like I first met you on
social
media.
You on social media.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think that it can be a way for people to connect and feel less alone. But I do think that the lines between, you know, IRL interaction and social media interaction have been blurred, where to the point where people today, it's all the same. And I don't think it's actually the same. It's not, I don't think it's equivalent, but it's starting to replace a lot of in-person interaction, and I do think that that can lead to isolation. But I don't think social media is all bad, and so I think it is important. It's hard to talk about this stuff with nuance, but I think it's important to talk about it with nuance. And Yeah, I mean, I just think that personal face-to-face interaction is still an important part of the human condition.
Yay.
Thank you.
Ellen, do you have anything you want to add?
Well, about Facebook. And so I'll talk about it again from the inside out, from the technical perspective. I see all these things, you know, we're complaining about Facebook. Well, Facebook, you know, has to, you know, fix this. It has to fix this, has to fix that. And here is where I have real gloom about algorithms controlling the world. Facebook is a big set of algorithms, you know, with a front end on it that is not your friend. And to say that Facebook is going to fix things, it's naive, technically. Because changing an algorithm to affect the things that people want to happen, how can you do this? Google says it's going to disallow extremist ads. Define that to a computer. This is the issue, because these algorithms work the way they do, and wanting a computer to have more intelligence in this mass situation, we're talking billions of posts and interactions. It's beyond what a human curator can do. Facebook says, I'm going to hire, 5,000 people to look through the posts. Come on. I mean, 5,000 editors couldn't, it's beyond human curation. And this is my real gloom. So I have hope and I have despair.
Doree, I want to go a little bit back to your reading and back to Sabrina, who, as you said, is 36 and has a 26-year-old boss, and the company's run by another 25-year-old, or what have you. And then, can I spoil it a tiny bit? She ends up getting promoted at the end. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily for her skill, but sort of just to have a woman with a high-ranking position. And it does feel, I mean, I grappled with her promotion because I didn't necessarily know why she was promoted so rapidly, and I was happy again to see her promoted, but obviously it wasn't for the right reason. So how do you sort of grapple with that, with wanting to move up the ranks, but maybe knowing that you are not doing that for right reasons?
Right. Since you brought it up, I feel like I have to spoil something a tiny bit.
You guys have read the book.
But her promotion...
You can't spoil this book.
Yeah, thank you. Her promotion comes kind of as an act of retribution against her boss. Yeah. You know, I think that that is something that does happen where women are pitted against each other, whether deliberately or subconsciously, and that's a really toxic thing to happen. And Sabrina... You know, Sabrina really finds herself throughout the book kind of in the middle of a lot of things. And I wanted to show her own personal struggle with, she feels like a professional failure. And how can she kind of, she has been working hard and she has been actually doing good work and she should be rewarded for that. But it necessarily comes at the detriment of someone else, which, unfortunately is something that I think happens.
We all read the news, I would hope, and I was reading this story earlier by my colleague Amanda Hess. So she wrote the story about separating the art from the artist, which is something that I thought is applicable to what we'd be talking about today. She goes on to sort of compare how a sneaker or a technology company tries to distract the consumer from the vile production process by churning out covetable products. And so the thrust of her story is that sexual misconduct is a labor issue, right? It makes people unable to do the best work that they possibly can. And I would like to hear from both of you about that, about how sexual harassment misconduct in the workplace can actually prohibit people from doing their best work.
I'll just tell you what's happened to me. I don't know in general. I'm not a journalist. I read the New York Times.
Thank you.
So Oh, just one instance that is in the book. I worked for a company where I had to go fix somebody's software at their office. I had to travel somewhere in the desert. It was horrible. I stayed at a place where the wind blew out the hot water heater. So, cold shower. And I get there and I'm sitting and working workstation. And this man, he's sort of sweaty hands, and he was wearing like a polyester shirt, I mean, way from the 70s. And he kept, and pendulous earlobes. And he kept rubbing his hand up and down my back, up and down my back, up and down my back. And, you know, so I changed seats, right? Up and down my back, up and down my back. And, you know, I thought, this guy's going to snap my bra. I know, how did I handle this? And I really look back on it, and I still find it a quandary. At the time, I wanted to put a bomb in his system that would explode 6 months in advance and set down his entire system and, you know, kill his files and everything. I didn't. I mean, I had pride in my work. See, this is, I'm going to do a great job despite this guy. He's a jerk. And that's how I try to handle it. But in the sort of, there are gradations of this. And this was something, I was just going to think, this man's a jerk. And I'm going to do my job. I'm going to let him know that he can't get me, right? And I did that a lot as I worked because I wanted to have pride in my work. I wanted to do my best work. So it's exactly on the struggle. But as I look back on it, I thought, maybe I made a mistake. Where is the punky old me that didn't blow up his system? And I, to this day, I don't know if I made the right decision. There is exactly, to kind of blow up a situation, literally, which I think applies to what's going on now, everyone coming out and saying, me too, me too. Now, in Hollywood, that's impossible. I mean, in this instance, it's just one person. Or just say, I'm going to do my job. And I think in Hollywood, separating the art from the artist, especially actors, is impossible. Because acting comes from your person. It isn't to pretend. And so I don't think that can be separated.
One thing that I do explore in my book is kind of what you were just alluding to, Jasmine, about the way that the lines between work and play have been blurred, in part because you are expected to spend all of your time at work. So therefore, you have the ping pong tables and the yoga rooms and you have all of the trappings of an extracurricular lifestyle. And I say extracurricular deliberately because in a lot of ways it does mimic college. And I think a lot of these people in their early and mid-20s who have only known college and this work environment, this feels very natural to them. But that also necessarily, I think, leads to a lot of confusion and blurred lines. And you see a lot of startups brag about their flat organizational structure, which I think is also confusing to people. People actually like to know who their manager is. What their expectations are, and
what a concept.
I know. and so I think that what happens in my book is that someone gets sexually harassed who doesn't really realize she's being sexually harassed, in part because these lines have been so blurred, and that's something that Sabrina really has to wrestle with too. There, at one point, she gets invited to the whole workplace is going to a pole dancing workshop together.
All right.
And she's like, what is happening? this is, I think, a new thing, a new way of working. You were talking before about separating the art from the artist, and I think something that we've seen happen, like with Uber, is that when Susan Fowler initially brought these allegations of harassment against her manager, she was told, well, he's a high performer. We're not gonna punish him. And so I think that is something that's a culture that needs to be changed. And I've now forgotten what your actual question was.
Girl, me too.
Can I just add one thing
yes,
to this?
Yes, of course, while we remember.
In my experience, there are these conferences, I can name a few of them, that they make efforts to bring women in. They do kind of outreach to women. And this engenders in many of the men a fierce resistance. It's almost atavistic. Mm. The attitude is, and I've seen it shouted out and written down, you know, can't the bitches just make it on their own? You know, I mean, this is ugly. I mean, it gets ugly. So there's this blowback against efforts to bring women in. One of them, they give them post-it notes to say nice things about what was happening and how good this effort was. And, you know, within half a day, the notes turn pornographic. The attack of women as a body, you know, it turns women into a body. And that is the sort of underlying ugliness of that.
So we've spent some time talking about the people who are explicitly terrible to women, but how have you seen, or how would you recommend people who, you know, sort of expect less from you, or call you sweetie, honey, darling, or men who are maybe it's a little less precise?
That's the more insidious kind of harassment, because it's harder to pinpoint, mm-hmm. and it's often not illegal. It's hard to bring a complaint about it, but I think that a lot of people's subconscious biases often come out. And I think, you know, I really think the best way to combat all of this is really like a structural change, where more women need to be promoted, more women need to be in charge, more women need to be making the rules. And that behavior should not be tolerated. I mean, I personally cannot stand those books that are basically telling women how to like navigate the workplace, because the assumption is that women are the ones who have to change their behavior to, you know, succeed in this workplace culture, when in fact it's the culture that needs to change. So that's where we should start.
How much time do we have left? I want to make sure we have enough time for questions. Oh, all right. So let's do questions. Right over here.
Ellen, did you have, besides putting up with the creep with his hand on your back or blowing up his software, did it occur to you, would it occur to you now, to turn around and say, please take your hand off me? I mean, is that another option?
I wouldn't say please.
Hi, it seems to me that some of the problem can be, goes way back to education. In the olden days, my husband went to an all-boys high school for science. Girls were just not allowed. Has the change in education been enough, or are girls still being steered away from the sciences and math and all the things that go into high-tech jobs?
This, you know, people talk about STEM, and the people who work in the education side of this try harder and harder and harder to get women, again, to find out if you like this stuff. Hey, I love this robotics contest, you know? But it's really discriminatory. You know, women are softer. Someone from the New York Times, who I respect very much, called me after the Damore memo came out and said, well, she said, well, don't you think women are, you know, more empathetic? No. Maybe, the girls are then, this is deep from the time they're babies, you know, are taught, you're softer, you're more caring. And that's the part, talk about changing the culture. That's how deep it goes.
Could you just talk a little bit about the role women have in kind of the sisterhood and keeping each other up, because we're talking about an industry where if you are one of the few women to make it, a lot of the time it's also on the backs of other women, as opposed to we all rise together. And that's actually been much more of my experiences, women in power who don't like other powerful women. And that's hard. And so if you have comments, not a direct question, but comments.
I think, unfortunately, a lot of women in power now came up in a time when it was a zero-sum game. There was only room for one woman. And that is how they have been conditioned to think. I think that the current generation has the opportunity to change that, and I think it's really important to have alliances with other women. I've talked to a lot of female founders of companies, and they all have told me, like I talked to a bunch in New York, and they were like, we all know each other, we all talk, we know, you know, we know which VCs are gonna give us money, we know which VCs are gonna be, you know, discriminating against us. And I think that is really important. I think in the workplace, it's also really important to, you know, form alliances. Sounds kind of cynical, but I think it is. It is really important to have those allies in the workplace and to work together, because like it really is a rising tide lifts all boats. I think
there are these meetups. I'm on these lists. I go to some. They're for, you know, Girls Code in San Francisco. You know, meet up, you know, where women for different, they want to find funding, they want to learn algorithms, they want to learn Ruby, and they do help each other. The problem with it is that they're geographically prejudiced. You know, you'll find a zillion in, not a zillion, but you'll find tens of thousands in Bay Area and in New York and here, I'm sure. But these are some of the ways that women who are interested in technology are rising together.
Yeah.
One more.
I've been in and out of software since 1990. 2 years ago, I took as a refresher, an intro to Java course at PCC. And out of the 32 students that were in it, most of whom were under age 22, there was two women, and the rest were men. And I have children, and I participated in FIRST Robotics with them. Surprisingly enough, there's a lot of girls participating in FIRST, but it seems to me like, as a parent, that from the ages of, say, middle school to college, they just disappear from software development. And do you have any suggestions on how that can be changed? I mean, I'm not sure how much of it's cultural or what, but all I can report is what I've seen, and I just don't see. I mean, I'm glad there's stuff going on in San Francisco, but I'm just not seeing the numbers of women, of college women, going into programming that there should be. And I was wondering what you think is causing that and what needs to be fixed to make that stop.
Like the entire culture, starting from boys being called buddy and girls being called princess. All right, we can just start right there. So it's going to be a long process. I think it's one of these things that people have to get off Facebook, and they have to go face to face, they have to go door to door, they have to agitate politically. Even things like daycare affect how girls will place it. Public education funding that's being slashed. Go to a charter school owned by the Secretary of Education. but it needs political organizing. We have to get out and join societies locally so you can work together in an area, and you can go into a school or a certain district and work on the ground. That sort of political organizing has kind of fallen out with the internet. Now, it's great, people do meet up, they support each other's interests, but when you form a group that can withstand political problems, gain and lose, and gains a kind of cohesion to reinvent the civic culture in the ground, where you tolerate your neighbors, you know, that kind of thing, and don't push them off the lawnmower and break their rib. You know, that's what I believe in. I think that's the way to change it. People have to go back to old-fashioned political organizing. And parents and fathers and mothers go into the school and be active in there, or local groups go into the schools. That's the way to do it, in my opinion.
All right, I think that's an excellent place to end. Guys, thank you so much for coming out today. Henry and Ellen, thank you.
That was a conversation between Dori Shafir and Ellen Ullman from 2017's Portland Book Festival, presented by Bank of America. The 2018 lineup has just been announced, and the festival will take place on November 10th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.